Thank you for joining us at the Roundtable.
Brought to you by Community Education Arts, a nonprofit organization based in Noblesville, Indiana.
I'm Alice Cavanaugh Scober, President of CE Arts.
And I'm Sarah E. Morin, Secretary of CE Arts. Let's sit down
at the Roundtable. Welcome back as we discuss our four nice selections this year, Jane Eyre, Gone with the Wind, Little Women, and Dracula. Let's move on to Little Women really briefly, because Little Women is probably the book that has the least amount of violence and domestic abuse in it, even though there's a war going on for part of this book, you know, at least in the first part, right? The Civil War is hanging over the March family, distantly. It's a fairly distant thing. I mean, father goes off to serve as chaplain and is wounded, but for the most part, the Civil War is not impacting them on a daily basis and moment by moment the way we see in Gone with the Wind, for example. So, but once their father has been wounded, then of course the fears for his well-being haunt them and everything until he returns home with Marmee, who's gone first to nurse him and then to bring him home to recover. So the violence of war is not in your face in Little Women. It's back there, though. It's like that river in the back of your mind. You know, they're not, they always know it's there. They, you know, the girls feel it, I'm sure. I think you can read between the lines sometimes when they're afraid for their father and the war and the soldiers and everything. I mean, I think it's an interesting way that Louisa May Alcott wrote the book to have that be, I mean, anybody who's lived through a time of war, it's, you know, even if it's happening in another country, if you live in a country where the soldiers are in another, your soldiers are fighting, it's pretty pervasive, you know. In the modern times, in the modern world. So for the Civil War, which is such a huge event in the history of the United States of America, right? To have it be in this story as kind of a background, constant, slightly disturbing thing is an interesting way to frame this little domestic story, if you will. I think it's interesting that way.
Right. Yeah. Right, yeah, because the war doesn't enter it as much as you would think it would.
No, I mean, yeah. it's hardly there at all. You know, I mean, it's really, if it wasn't for their father, it wouldn't even be there. And it's almost, I'll be honest with you and say, when I was little and I read the book, I thought that the war was Louisa May Alcott's way of getting the father figure out of the main action of the story. That it was a vehicle to remove him, so it was the mother and the four girls and their lives. And I love that, because it was like one of my first little feminist books. It was, okay, we don't need that guy, you know. And also, the more I learned about Louisa May Alcott's real life and the influence her father had and all that stuff, I sort of thought it was a really interesting thing that she did to remove him from so much of the main thrust of the story. And so I've always kind of had a little internal chuckle with that, because it's almost like she was dissing that patriarchal thing that, you know, we find in Western European culture so much, and it's like, oh, well, we'll just remove him. We'll just send him to war, you know, and he's not really part of the story for a while. Right. But that's just my interpretation. I don't expect everybody else to feel that way about his character.
I don't think that you're wrong there. And it is kind of, they do have a lot more power than to decision make with him being gone.
Yeah.
And yes. Even when he is there, he's kind of like, you know, here's a small sentencing, and he gave some good, wise advice, and then he disappears again for three chapters.
Well, and when we talk about religion and spirituality, I'm going to equate him with a God figure, an absent, invisible, all-powerful, omniscient figure in the sky somewhere, because it's through, you know, they know he wants them to be his good little women, right? He writes that letter. And so even though they are in control of their own actions and behaviors, that, like a lot of organized religious dogma, is like hanging over their heads. His perception of them, what he wants them to be, how he wants them to behave. He. It is always there. But he has been effectively removed from the action, which is, you know, if you want to interpret it that way, you could say that Louisa May Alcott did a very clever thing by having the father become like this godlike being, you know, that's absent, invisible, and yet still has that power, you know, over their lives and their thoughts and their behaviors. Now, like all humans, do they mess up? Yes. Do they live up to his standards? Not always. I mean, it's a morality tale, right? I mean, it's a very kind of obvious one. But I do appreciate it for my own tongue-in-cheek interpretation of it a little bit more than that spiritual interpretation of it, of why she got rid of his character for a while. But and as for domestic abuse, by today's standards, you know, the worst we can say is that some of the scenes, you know, in relationship issues are a little bit cringeworthy. And, you know, Meg seems to, we've talked about this a little bit before, Meg's chapters as a wife, you know, are kind of the most cringy. They're not really representative of physical abuse at all. We're not talking about that. But that kind of, that control abuse within gender norm, patriarchal dominance stuff is definitely there. And in the context of the time period, it's perfectly understandable. That's the way it was, right? And perfectly acceptable. However, you know, by the modern standard, it's like, bleh, you know, yeah, it's a good marriage, but, you know, don't really like that sometimes.
I want to hear you with your analogy here to I Love Lucy.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is kind of, I don't know, maybe I'm going out way too far on the limb, but, you know, Meg's marriage definitely, I'm not saying it's abusive. It doesn't meet abuse standards. But, you know, if you think about the I Love Lucy TV show and Meg's domestic chapters, you know, the tradition of Lucy and Ethel, like, going shopping and then hiding all their shopping from their husbands so they wouldn't know how much they spent. Okay? Oh my God, overcoat chapter from Little Women, right? Meg in the overcoat. Meg in the dress that she bought, the fabric for the dress that she buys instead of buying the new overcoat. You know, I mean, you know, there's this tradition in American culture. I'm assuming it's, you know, Western European culture, something, where women are hiding things from their husbands, you know, that have to do with money, right? And so that sort of made me wonder, given the time period this book was written, was that something that Louisa May Alcott noticed? Or is Meg's, did Meg's character kind of almost instigate some of the I Love Lucy-esque things that we've grown up, you know, in later generations with, you know, pop culture and mainstream things like TV shows. I can't list a sitcom that doesn't have that element in it somewhere. You know, no matter how modern the wife is, no matter if she's a, you know, whatever her job is, whatever she's, there's always an episode or two where that she's keeping a secret of something she bought or something like that from the husband. And now, to be fair, in some of the more recent, you know, sitcoms that we've seen on TV, that they reverse it and they have the husband trying to hide that he bought a new tool or, you know, a jet ski or I don't know, you know, something that, you know, he's trying to hide from her that he did something like that. But the more prevalent thing across time has been that, you know, the wife is hiding something like a shopping thing from the husband. And that just made me think of Meg's chapter about buying the fabric for the dress and when John really needed a new overcoat. And then you think about Mad Men, you know, the TV show Mad Men, and Meg's jam-making, you know, chapter where John brings his boss home for dinner without telling her, and she's been making jam all day, and the house is a wreck, right? And that almost had a Mad Men-esque 1950s housewife feel to it, you know? So, I don't know. These are just some of the things that kind of I wouldn't go so far as to say that these go into the realm of domestic abuse, but it's more this idea of inequality, and that there, you know, inequality breeds secrecy, and it also breeds situations that are unfair to one of the people involved, like her being making jam all day only to have her husband bring, you know, his boss home. That was kind of unfair of him to do, even though she had said, oh, bring me any time, you know. It's still, in reality, you think, well, she's got to prepare dinner. She's got to have time for that. And back in the day, preparing dinner for three people instead of two people was a huge difference in terms of how much money you were spending on your food allowance and everything. And again, she had a food allowance. I mean, you know, if you think about all those things, you'd be like, cringy, you know. But,
right.
You know, that's where I come in with the I Love Lucy and Mad Men. I was just like,
right.
You know.
So those observations, I think, are very correct. And what's interesting to me is that we are dealing with a time where women are starting to have more financial control mm-hmm. over the domestic arena.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean they have control over the overall family decisions,
right.
And decisions of finances.
They're still answerable to a man, usually
right.
The husband or a father or something, or whoever hired them to be the housekeeper or something, you know.
Right. And so Meg's deciding to go spend something on herself like this,
yeah,
when not approved by the husband, is also, she has failed in her own domestic role
right.
of responsibly taking care of domestic finances.
Right. She's given in to a whim. She's given in to being a little selfish. And she's also given in to it's a common theme that has run in Meg's life in this book, is wanting to be admired, wanting to be seen as beautiful, you know, she, that the flattery of others kind of a thing, and how, because she gets, that situation happens when she's younger, and she's at the ball, and they dress her up like a doll kind of a thing. So we've seen Meg kind of give in to her own, gosh, there's a word for that. I can't think of the word. Where, you know, where you care what people think, how you look and everything, and I don't know.
Vanity?
Yes, thank you. Vanity. That was the word. Thank you. You read my mind. I just couldn't get my brain to think that word. Yes, she has given into her own vanity a little bit and rues the day, of course, and makes it all good in the end. But it's an interesting little segment. I think Meg's life is a little more interesting in some ways than some of the other characters for these reasons that you know, she's in a relationship that we see very real scenes of, you know.
That's true.
Join us next time as we continue our discussion in our four nice books, Jane Eyre, Gone with the Wind, Little Women, and Dracula. This has been At the Roundtable with Alice
and Sarah E.
of Community Education Arts.
Our nonprofit organization is based in Noblesville, Indiana. You can find us online at cearts.org. We'd like to thank James Weston for writing our intro music and for his technical savvy.
Join us next time
at the Roundtable.